Today is March the 2nd, 2017. I'm Eric Leegee. This is the Small Town Jewish History Project for the Rao Jewish History Program and Archives at the Heinz History Center. I'm talking to Bob Myers, and we are at Providence Point. So, Bob, why don't you start by telling me how your family got to New Kensington?
When my Myers family lived in Pittsburgh, where my father was born, New Kensington was a brand new town being developed, and to attract people to come and move to New Kensington, they offered a free train ride from Pittsburgh to New Kensington to have people look at the layout of the town and purchase lots to build homes. My grandmother Myers took that train trip, bought three lots, and within a year or so, my grandfather built some houses. He had a landsman in Pittsburgh who was a builder. We would today call him a contractor. And they worked together, and he would build one house at a time and sell the houses. And that's how the family came to New Kensington. My father was 5 years old at that time, and the town was fairly new. My mother once told me they had wooden sidewalks. And there was a suburban trolley streetcar that went from Pittsburgh to New Kensington and then on to Natrona Heights. And many people took the streetcar, which was a long ride. The train service was rapid, but there weren't that many trains a day.
How did the family get to Pittsburgh in the first place? Because your grandfather wasn't born.
My grandfather was born in Russia. Grandfather Myers was an only child.
What was his name?
His name was David. Wait a second. His name was David Moses.
David Moses Myers.
Wait a second. I'm mixed up. Okay. That's my mother's father. My grandfather Myers, as I was telling you, was an only child. He decided to come to the United States. And his mother did not want to come to this country. She moved to Palestine.
Huh.
And my father would correspond with her over the years. And they kept in touch. He worked his way across the state. He had relatives in Philadelphia, which was a port of entry at that time.
Your grandfather.
My grandfather, Myers. And he worked his way.
Terrace.
He worked his way across the state. It was right after the Johnstown flood, I was told.
Okay.
And then came to Pittsburgh, where he had a couple of months light. And I just told you about how they came to New Kensington.
Yeah.
And he was in the scrap business, sold or bought scrap from the fledgling Aluminum Company of America, which established their first plant in New Kensington. And that was the major industry in that community and helped build it. But there were many, many other factories in the area. Pittsburgh Plate Glass, American Window Glass, Ford Motor Company had a glass plant. The community developed rather rapidly. And by the 1920s, it was a pretty thriving community, a very, very good business town. It was the business hub for a 10-mile radius, I would say. And people shopped there from all over. Saturday nights, the streets were crowded with people. The sidewalks were, you could hardly walk through. This went on for a number of years until World War II.
Were people shopping, or were they just socializing?
Both. But it was a business hub.
Huh.
And that's why there were so many Jewish merchants who, for the most part, became quite successful.
Do you know how your grandfather and your grandmother met?
No.
Do you know why your grandmother was the one who went to New Kensington to look at the lots?
I guess she was aggressive. Or perhaps my grandfather was busy and didn't have the time to do that.
Yeah.
I really do not know, but I know she went by herself.
It's interesting that your grandparents had the presence of mind to go into real estate, that they saw that as a real estate opportunity. Was that unusual?
I don't know if it was unusual, but there were certainly opportunities because it was a really new city, and there were many opportunities for new housing.
Did he learn about it through the scrap business? Was there any connection there?
Not that I know of.
Okay. So your grandparents go to New Kensington, and then how many children do they have? They have seven.
Seven.
Okay. And your father is the second, Benjamin.
Second from the youngest.
Second from the youngest or the oldest?
Not there were older ones.
We have Katie, Benjamin, Frida, Gussie, Jacob, Harry, and Ella.
I think we're missing one. I'll have to think for a moment.
We can always find it.
All right.
So what business did your grandfather go into in New Kensington?
Well, he started out in the scrap business, and then he opened a furniture store.
Do you know why?
Because there was a market for it.
Okay.
That was obvious. But it was not the business that my father went into. He opened his own store after he graduated from high school, went to a business college, and then he opened his own furniture store in 1910.
In New Kensington?
In New Kensington.
Was he a competitor of your father's?
No, my grandfather was already out of that business.
Okay.
He was retired.
Okay.
And he was a Sabbath observer. So the store was not open on Sabbath, and I don't know to what extent it was successful. I had no knowledge about the store at all.
The
it was
first
called,
store.
Called my grandfather's store. It was called the Standard Furniture Company.
Okay.
That's all I know about it.
And your dad's was called what?
Myers Furniture.
Okay.
The town, as I say, grew when my parents first came to live in New Kensington. There was no available housing, and they were able to rent most of a large house owned by a woman who was an old family. Her family were old-time residents of the community called Parnassus, which is adjacent to New Kensington and became part of New Kensington in the 1930s. But Parnassus was an established community, quite small, and Miss Glass was one of the prominent residents of Parnassus. The man who headed Alcoa at that time, the president, was Arthur Vining Davis, who was a well-known national figure, very involved with Florida real estate in subsequent years. When he came to visit his Alcoa plant in New Kensington, he stayed with Miss Glass. And my parents had a very nice relationship with her. Within the year, they were able to find a house. And then about 5 years later, my father built a house in a new residential street in New Kensington where they lived. After his death, my mother remarried a man who also lived on that same street, Charles Avenue. So that's the story of how my family came to New Kensington and asked him that question.
We spoke about this a little before, but just to get it on tape, how did your parents meet, your mother and father?
My grandmother Myers had a sister who lived in Philadelphia. Her brother-in-law was the brother of my mother's father, my grandfather Moses. And they had a daughter with whom my mother was friendly. They were about the same age. And when her cousin was about to be married and my mother was invited to the wedding, she was reluctant to go. And her mother said, "Well, Jen, you have a new dress. You should go to the wedding." So my mother went. My father's first cousin, who was the bride, also, my father went to that wedding, and that's where my parents met.
What did your mother think of this part of the state?
Cultural shock. It was quite a different life from what she had in Philadelphia, where she was involved with, had many, many friends. from high school and from the community, and that's quite different.
What was the observance, level of observance, like in your house growing up?
As you would probably imagine, my grandparents were quite observant Orthodox Jews. My grandfather was one of the community leaders. He had a study session every Shabbat afternoon at his home. And of course, my mother grew up in an Orthodox home also, so there was no question that her home would be kosher. Our family was always very involved with the synagogue in New Kensington. We'll get to that shortly, talking about how the synagogue came to be established.
Yeah.
But
you kept kosher growing up?
Oh, yes.
And all the holidays and...
Observed everything. When my mother remarried a man who the household was never kosher, my mother kept a kosher-style house. Blatantly non-kosher food, but there was a mixture of dishes and so forth.
Where did kosher families get their food in New Kensington?
Well, there was a kosher butcher, and there was another family who had a place where they sold chickens.
Live chickens?
Well, they killed them before they delivered them.
Right.
There was also a kosher butcher, a butcher in Tarentum who had a regular market, but they had a kosher department, and every once a week they had kosher slaughter. And they delivered to the house.
Really?
Both places did. Schwartz was the one in New Kensington, and Weick's in Tarentum.
And how long did that last?
Until the late 1940s.
That's really interesting.
There was also a fish market in New Kensington, and of course fish is not treif, and they got fresh fish in it every Thursday.
From where?
Wherever they brought it from.
Yeah.
I guess it was packed in ice, and most Jewish women would go to the fish store to buy fish, and they would... The owner of the fish market once said to my mother something about, well, we know that the Catholics all eat fish on Friday, and I guess the Jews observe Thursday for their fish day.
What were your parents like? What were their personalities like?
My father died when I was quite young. I don't know a great deal about his personality. I know that he was extremely well-liked. He had many friends. He was very congenial. He was an excellent businessman. He was a pretty nice guy, very well liked. My mother was a very remarkable woman. She was physically very, very beautiful, and many people have commented to me about that as I was growing up and in later years. When she first came to New Kensington, and she would walk from where they lived to the Myers Furniture Store, which was about five blocks away. And one of the women, who later became a neighbor, said that the women would all go to their windows to watch to see my mother walk by, to see how she was dressed, because she brought a wardrobe from Philadelphia. She was quite well received. My parents both had many friends in the non-Jewish community. They were involved in a number of activities and community organizations.
So was that unusual?
No. In small town life, I think that was very usual.
Yeah.
But I mentioned that my mother was very active in the synagogue, the sisterhood, community organizations like the Quota Club, and my father was involved. Most men in business joined various men's organizations for business reasons. Like my father was a member of the Elks, which I don't know if anybody belongs to anymore. I don't think he ever went to a meeting. But my parents took a trip to a national Elks convention, in 1936 for their 20th anniversary. And there were Elks members from throughout the country who went to this, and they had home hospitality. It was a super deluxe trip, which I don't think could be in existence today. They had a special train from Chicago to L.A. The train had a beauty shop, a diner, of course, and a club car, and all kinds of extra things. And in Los Angeles area, they were entertained by Elks members. My parents were guests of a man who had a prune ranch, or I guess plums where they made prunes, but it was a very, very big operation. And then for their return, they took a cruise from Los Angeles down the coast of Mexico through the Panama Canal and back to New York. And when they arrived in New York, there was a line in the New York Times, Mr. and Mrs. Benjamin Myers arrived today in New York from Los Angeles. So it was a very big deal.
We talked about this a little before, but just to get it on tape, could you explain what the Quota Club is?
Quota Club was an international organization of women executives, primarily women who were business owners or executives or people in public life. And they did good deeds. They had scholarships for women in various categories. In New Kensington, I know they gave scholarships to young women who were going into nursing. And that was one of the areas in which they supplied scholarships.
Was your mother involved in the business before your father passed away?
Somewhat. Never in the sales end, but she was involved in the administration. In the office, she made up the payroll every week. That was one of her functions.
And she just moved into the other work when your father died.
That's correct. She hired a manager for the store, and then World War II broke out. My brothers both went into the army. I was still in high school.
And you have two brothers.
Two older brothers.
Yes.
Right. So.
So they were both in the service?
Yes.
But you're much younger than they?
7 years younger, but then I still went in 1944 when I graduated from high school. I enlisted.
Wow.
And so I was in till the early days of the occupation.
Did you go overseas?
Yes, I went to Japan.
Huh.
I was based in Tokyo. A wonderful experience.
Can you tell me about it?
Sure. This was the early days of the occupation. And I had been recruited to go into the counterintelligence corps. And that was about a year and a half of schooling. I took Japanese language courses at the University of Pennsylvania, then went to a CIC school. And there were a group from our Japanese program who were recruited for CIC. Of our group of 90 men in the Japanese program, 16 of us went into the CIC. And after our training, we were shipped to Japan, to various parts of the country, all throughout Japan. And I developed some very close friendships at that time. And we were supposed to stay for a year and a half, but after a year they decided that some of us should be sent back and discharged unless we re-enlisted again. So a few of the guys stayed over and re-enlisted for a third time.
And what was involved in the work?
We did investigative work. We reported every week to General MacArthur, whose headquarters was in Tokyo, and that was one of my major duties, preparing a report for General MacArthur, a top secret report. It was fascinating work.
Yeah, I imagine. What was the state of, by 44, the war wasn't over in the Japan?
No, it wasn't even over in
Right. Europe.
It was over while I was at VMI.
So was this undercover work that you were doing?
In Japan?
Yeah.
I did administrative work, but occasionally I was sent out on a couple of surveillances. It was undercover, yes.
So it was maybe not battle lines, but it was war, a war zone.
No, this was after the war. This was the occupation.
Okay.
This was in 1946.
Oh,
we went over in the fall of 45.
Okay.
Came back. I came back in 47.
So were you over there when the bombs dropped?
Oh, no. That was during wartime. There were no American troops there.
But you enlisted in 44.
I enlisted in 44, but I went to college in the Army.
Okay,
they sent me to the University of Pennsylvania.
So by the time you got over there, the war was over.
That's right.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's go back a little bit. Tell me a little bit about your schooling in New Kensington.
There was... the grade school that I went to was in a very old building. My father went to school in that same building. It was just, there were half a dozen elementary schools, but just one high school. And in later years, New Kensington and Arnold, the adjacent community, merged to be one school district with one high school, junior high and high school. They had some pretty good students who became quite successful, although I cannot give you any names.
What was it like being a kid in New Kensington in the 30s and 40s?
It was a wonderful place to grow up. We had a very nice Jewish community, small but active. For the boys, it was an AZA that was very active, and a co-ed organization of Young Judea, which was the Zionist-sponsored youth organization. And we had activities all the time. Most weekends there was some activity in one of the small towns in the area. So we traveled a lot.
What were the other things that kids did back then for fun? Was there sports?
There were sports. We had a wonderful high school football team. That was a championship team for a number of years. I had a relationship with one of the football players in later years from my high school class, but that's another story for another time. But football was the big deal. And there was also a very strong basketball team at our high school. And one of the star players was a Jewish member of the community who was small, but very, very fast.
Was there cultural things in New Kensington?
Yes, there was a concert series organized by one of the members of the Jewish community, the Civic Concert Association. They brought in artists from all over the country. I think there were perhaps four or five concerts during the year. There was a speaker's lecture series that was sponsored by B'nai B'rith, and this was in the 1940s during the wartime. And the program started with the singing of the Star Spangled Banner, and I was the pianist for that. So we had some interesting cultural things. There was also a community theater program, little theater, amateur theatrics. There were about six movie theaters.
Wow.
And they all were busy. And there were many men's organizations, the different kinds of lodges and clubs. And most of the non-Jews had church-centered activities, so there was a lot to do.
Did the Jewish kids get along with the rest of the kids?
Oh, yes. It was very integrated. Some of my very close friends are non-Jewish, and we still have a group. My high school class started to have high school reunions every 5 years. The first reunion, I was still in Japan. But after that, I chaired every reunion until our 70th reunion, and we decided not to have any more. But a group of us still get together for lunch twice a year, about a dozen of us who are still around. So we have very happy memories of our high school days.
Let's talk a little bit about the congregation.
Okay.
What do you know about how it was, about its early days and how it was started?
The earliest days in the late 1890s, as soon as there were enough people for a minyan, and this was an Orthodox group, they would have Shabbat services. As I mentioned, my grandfather Myers was a Shomer Shabbos and as were some of the other men at that time. And in the early part of the 20th century, where the Jewish population had grown, the women decided that they needed a Sunday school. So by that time, there was already a Jewish cemetery established some years before that. That was one of the first things that was established. And the synagogue building was a small frame building in the downtown area of New Kensington. A Sunday school was established on the same street where the synagogue, Beth Jacob, was later built. And the Sunday school was a progressive one, organized by a Mrs. Weinberg, who was a teacher. And I guess by the mid-1920s, the Jewish community was large enough that they decided that they needed a permanent, good structure of a synagogue. And they hired an architect from Pittsburgh who designed several other synagogues in Pittsburgh. His name was Alexander Shirov. And the synagogue was built. The original plans, my mother told me this later, had a mikveh.
Really?
And the women who were on the committee or else involved vocally said that we do not need a mikveh. So that area that was designated as a mikveh became a sukkah, which was used for storage during the year, except for Sukkot. The opening in the roof was removed so that it was exposed to the daylight. But that was originally designed to be a mikveh.
That's fascinating. With that story and with the progressive religious school, does that mean that there was, in general, in the early 20th century, a move toward conservative reform?
Yes. So the community, Jewish community, was made up of people who some were had a strong Orthodox background and practice. Others, some were Reform, and the vast majority felt that they were more modern and would be conservative. So the synagogue was designed to serve people of all persuasions in the Jewish community. When the synagogue sanctuary was built for the seating, the center area, which was the largest one, had mixed seating. The area on the right was for men only, and the area on the left was for women only. And there was a balcony, and usually only women sat on the balcony and children. And that lasted for many, many years until the sanctuary was remodeled and there was a center aisle. So there was all mixed seating.
That sounds unusual. Was that a rare setup?
I don't know.
That's very interesting. What was the religious school like? You said it was progressive. What does that mean?
I don't remember saying that.
Okay.
The cheder, most of the boys and many of the girls went to cheder, and it was an after-school program, 4 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. We had many different rabbis. Some lasted for 1 or 2 years, some stayed much longer, and we had, there were usually two classes of the Hebrew school, and had another teacher who was probably the assistant to the rabbi who assisted in services and other community activities.
Was the religious school part of Southwestern District?
It changed with each rabbi. Some of the rabbis we hired from time to time were Orthodox, Reform, or Conservative. So for many years, we were affiliated with the Southwestern District, which was a Reform organization that oversaw the Sunday schools in the whole area. And the textbooks reflected that particular administration. When a more Orthodox rabbi came, they disaffiliated from the Southwestern District and had a more conventional series of textbooks. So we changed books quite frequently. But we had a good Sunday school, and all the Jewish kids in the community attended.
Were there any noteworthy rabbis during your childhood that you remember?
Yes. One of them, most noteworthy, first of all, my mother was always very involved with the rabbis and their families. When a prospect came for interview, they always had dinner at our home or lunch or whatever, and developed personal relationships with many of the rabbis. One of the most notable was Henry Goldberger, who came, I believe, around 1930. I'm not sure of the dates. You could look that up. But he served as the rabbi until about 1936 and went to Altoona. At the time of my bar mitzvah in 1940, we had no rabbi at that time. That was a situation where Rabbi Goldberger said, "You'll come to Altoona and I'll prepare you for your bar mitzvah." Then he came to New Kensington for the weekend to officiate at the services. His son, Daniel Goldberger, became a rabbi and was the Jewish education director in Denver, Colorado for many, many years. And his daughter, Sonia, married the Hillel director at State College. So we sort of kept in touch over the years. The next very notable rabbi that I remember who came during the war years was from Montreal. His name was Julius Berger, and he was a widower and wanted to sort of be semi-retired and come to a small community where he wouldn't have too many duties. It didn't work out that way. But he had written a book that was published. My mother received a copy of the book, which was inscribed. It was a typewritten bound copy, which I donated one to the library at Adat Shalom, and I gave one to Rabbi Walter Jacob. Rabbi Berger's son was a professor at McGill University in Toronto, in Montreal. So those were a couple of very notable rabbis. We had many others that were interesting. One of the more recent ones in the 1950s was a man originally from Pittsburgh. I remember when we interviewed him, somebody asked him, "Can you blow a shofar?" And he said, "Oh, I certainly could. I played the trumpet in the Taylor Alderdice band." His name was Philip Labovitz. And some years later, after he had served in New Kensington for a number of years, he and his wife moved to Florida. And I was reading a magazine, I can't remember which one, my neighbor called this to my attention. There was a big article about Chautauqua Institution. And there was an item and a picture of Phil Labovitz, who was a tennis instructor at Chautauqua every summer.
When rabbis left, was it because the community was dissatisfied or because the rabbi was dissatisfied?
Maybe not either. Sometimes they just had better opportunities in larger communities. That would be the prime reason. Sometimes there was a dissatisfaction, but usually the rabbis left. I don't remember anybody ever firing or not renewing a contract.
Is rabbinic leadership a persistent problem for small towns during that time period? I mean, keeping someone for a long period of time?
Not always. Sometimes a rabbi would come and stay forever.
Yep.
That happened in many communities.
Right.
New Kensington just happened to have a very large turnover.
Okay. So after the war, you came back to New Kensington?
I did.
Directly?
I went to the University of Pittsburgh and got a degree there and then came back to New Kensington.
And what was the reason that you decided to come back to New Kensington?
My brothers. After my father's death, my brothers and I inherited the business. And so I was a partner with my two older brothers.
So they lived in New Kensington?
They lived in New Kensington. So they were waiting for me to come back and become an active part of the furniture business, and that's what happened to my life.
So one of the things that I think is very interesting about New Kensington is it seems like the social life of the congregation was much stronger than I've seen at other congregations.
It's very strong.
So could you describe it, and then if you can, explain why you think it was so strong?
Probably because there was leadership. There were a number of women's organizations. The Sisterhood was especially strong with good leadership. And there was also Hadassah and B'nai B'rith Women. But there were a lot of social activities built around the synagogue. Shortly after the end of World War II, when many of the males of the community were, after they returned from service, and the community, the Jewish community, enlarged. One of the major social events in the women's organization, Hadassah, had a what they called a donor luncheon every year for women who made a contribution to the organization, and they had to have a social program as part of their luncheon. So many of the women in the leadership decided that the men should be part of this festive activity and should be more than just a luncheon but an evening program with entertainment. So thus began a series of shows once a year, and my brother Sam was who was very clever at writing in the Mel Brooks style. They wrote a show, an original show, using music from other Broadway shows, and the one they were doing was South Pacific. And there were several scenes. It was very clever. The man they recruited to be the pianist, who was a marvelous pianist, could play Gershwin and all that kind of stuff. He could not be an accompanist. I was living at the fraternity house when attending the University of Pittsburgh, and I got a call from my brother Sam. He said, "Bob, you have to help us out. Mace cannot be an accompanist. You'll have to come and play the piano." So they had rehearsals on Saturday nights. And so I went out in New Kensington and became the rehearsal pianist and played for the performance. And there was a series of shows, one a year, for about a dozen years, all original scripts. We had a tiny stage before we built the addition to the synagogue. It was very makeshift, but everything worked. And that was the highlight of the season for many in the Jewish community, because this took several months to prepare and run the thing.
Have any of those scripts survived?
I don't think so. I had a couple, but I don't think they survived. One of the last ones was the man who came to donor, based briefly on the man who came to dinner, just by the title. And we had a professional orchestra. There was a man who played for Mr. Rogers. He was the pianist there, Johnny Costa, and he had a combo, and we engaged him to do the music. I didn't have to play the piano then. But I had a choreographer, a woman I knew from Pitt. One year we had Don Brockett, who became a big, big name in Pittsburgh. He worked on one of the shows with me. So we had a lot of fun. And this was a many-month activity for several of us.
Another interesting thing was the Mr. and Mrs. Club. What was that?
Well, that was just a group of friends who socialized together. My brothers were in another group called the Club 16. There were eight couples. And they got together once a month, usually at the home of one of the members, and a couple of times, once a year, often they took a trip. Like one year they went to Grossinger's, and I don't remember where else, but they remained very, very close throughout the year, not just their trips. They met once a month, but were in touch all the time.
When did the expansion happen?
It's in the book.
Okay.
Around 1950, in the early 50s, I don't remember the exact date.
What was the nature of the expansion? What was the goal? Just a bigger social hall, or was the sanctuary?
Well, that was the main. Yeah, the sanctuary remained the same except for reconfiguration and installation of stained glass windows. The social hall was a major addition, which was a beautiful hall with a complete professional stage with stage lighting and curtains, and the scene of really nice functions. One year, B'nai B'rith had a New Year's party. The man who chaired that, the theme was B'nai B'rith Goes British, and he had beefeater guards at the entrance and all kinds of fancy things like that.
Before we go forward, I just want to go back and make sure that we talked about the youth Jewish youth events when you were young.
All right.
Because you were part of the beginning of the AZA there, right?
Right, from the very beginning.
How did that get started?
It started with some members of AZA from nearby communities who came to, I guess, get us excited. And we had young man who was like sort of the counselor or advisor from the community. And most of the guys just wanted to be in it to play basketball because they had twice a month at least went to other communities for these activities.
Was part of the purpose of these the sort of things like BBYO or AZA or BBG, was the point for, I don't know if dating's the right word, but for boys and girls to be able to meet each other?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
How many marriages resulted from that? Very few, but it was a chance to socialize. Usually there were activities on Sunday with a dance Sunday evening, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So when did New Kensington start to get smaller?
After Alcoa closed. That was the death knell of the community, of the business community.
Yeah.
And then the people who were successful merchants or people who had other occupations, they died off. And the young people who grew up there and went away to college didn't come back. So that was the end, because there was no future in retail and everything changed.
How quickly did you feel the closure of Alcoa on the furniture business?
Oh, probably 5 years.
Did the store close 5 years later, or it took 5 years just to notice?
5 years. The store closed the store in New Kensington around 1950, and we had a store in Natrona Heights, which continued to run until, I think, 1956.
Okay. And then from there, what business did you go into?
I did go into business.
You went into the Israel Bonds?
That's correct.
Okay.
A year later, I had a year of retirement.
Since we're talking about it, let's talk about the merchant class. Was most of the business district Jewish-owned?
I'd say at least half, or perhaps more than half.
Were there any noteworthy businesses that you remember?
Yes. The two biggest stores were Silverman's Department Store and Hart's.
Hart's.
H-A-R-T. And Silverman's was the larger, physically larger store. And they had quite a staff of buyers and salespeople and so forth. Hart started out as a small store. Meyer Hart was in the art goods business. His wife became the buyer, and they put in a line of clothing, which became extremely successful. And they expanded, and before their demise, they had a chain of about a dozen stores in Western Pennsylvania and even West Virginia.
Were there any bakeries or delis or things like that?
There was not a Jewish bakery or deli.
Okay.
No, there was not.
And so a lot of these businesses started to close in the 50s with the end of Alcoa.
The town went downhill pretty rapidly.
Okay. Were there redevelopment efforts?
Yes, but not successful.
What happened to the synagogue in those years?
The membership dwindled, and about 18 years ago, the Sunday school, I think, had down to about a dozen children. And we had a rabbi at that time, Rabbi Irving Dick, who was very well liked. We decided, I chaired a long-range planning committee, and at that time we decided that we maybe had 3 or 4 years to go and that would be it. At the same time, the B'nai Israel Synagogue in Pittsburgh, their membership had moved primarily from the East End to the suburbs, to the North Hills, to the South Hills, to Monroeville. And they knew they had to make a change. Our congregation membership was somewhat similar and very compatible. A progressive, progressive conservative synagogue. So we, our New Kensington group looked for property to buy in Fox Chapel. We thought we could build a small, perhaps cinder block building to start with and add on and so forth. And when we met with some people from B'nai Israel and realized we had a common goal, we had to make a move to where the potential Jewish community would be located. Many of the Beth Jacob members had already moved to Fox Chapel. So with Rabbi Dick, we set up a Sunday school in Fox Chapel. We rented space in a church for Sunday mornings. And one of our members in New Kensington, Jim Kopelman, who you have met, was on the board of the hospital, which is now Southwest Harmerville Rehab. And they had purchased a girls' Catholic school adjacent to their property with the idea of expanding their facility, but they never did. The girls' Catholic school was built, it was a very beautiful modern structure, state of the art, but the Catholic girls' enrollment declined greatly and they closed the school and the building was empty and they sold it. And Jim Kopelman found that this would be a wonderful opportunity for B'nai Israel and Beth Jacob to form a new congregation into a building that could be adapted for our congregational use. And that's what happened.
And that was 1995? The mid-90s?
Yeah. Okay. 1995 is correct.
When did the long-range planning happen?
About 3 years before that.
So this might be too small a detail to remember, but that process is something that other congregations went through, and I'm wondering how congregations got the idea to have a committee to look at long-range planning. Was it just...
We just did it.
Okay.
We knew that we couldn't exist too much longer.
Okay. Had there been a lot of conversations like that in the decade or so before?
No, because we were still pretty vibrant.
Okay. I noticed that in one of the community histories, it talks about revising the Constitution in the 1980s, and I'm wondering if that was notable, if there was something specific that was part of that.
Not that I can recall.
Okay. Is there anything else from the community that we should talk about from the history of the community?
The members who were Orthodox were of an older generation. And in almost every case, not every case, but most every case, their children or the newcomers of the community no longer followed Orthodox practices. But you asked at one point about shopping for Jewish-type food. Most of the people from all of the small communities around Pittsburgh went into Pittsburgh on Sundays and purchased from the Jewish storekeepers, their supply of Jewish food, even though kosher meat was available locally and fish, not fish, but poultry, but everything else, people went other places. For Passover, they would bring in a number of Passover items to the synagogue, and the sisterhood had a Passover sale.
Matzah.
Yeah.
What was the relationship between New Kensington and some of the other small towns like Tarentum and Kiske Valley?
Well, they initially all had their own synagogues, but they eventually closed, and this few numbers of Jewish people who still lived there became affiliated with Beth Jacob in New Kensington.
Okay. Have you been back to New Kensington recently?
Within the year, downtown New Kensington is a ghost town. It is so depressing. The business section, two-thirds of the buildings have been completely demolished. They're empty lots. And the buildings that still remain are unoccupied. The residential areas are still very nicely maintained. And Penn State even opened a New Kensington branch. And there are just a very, very few businesses remaining. But for all intents and purposes, it's no longer viable.
What were the differences growing up Jewish in a small town to what you imagine growing up Jewish in, say, Squirrel Hill or the Hill District?
Even though we had a small number of Jewish children, there were about a dozen in my class, and so I was friendly with those people, plus a year or two ahead and a year or two behind, and we had a very, very friendly Jewish group growing up, very congenial, and with the organizations, we had friendships in the nearby communities. We established some close friendships with people in Tarentum and other nearby. That was the closest community. The others were really non-existent by the time of my teen years.
But do you think that you are more active in community things now because you grew up in a small town than you would have been if you had grown up in a city?
Possibly. Okay. Although I've been involved in activities all my life,
right.
So I don't know that that makes a big difference.
Okay. Is there anything else we should talk about?
No, not at this moment. You may, when you go over your notes, you may have some questions.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.